Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us is John Rambo, the new Vice President and General Manager of Lockheed Martin's Integrated Warfare Systems and Sensor Units in what is his first interview since taking the job. Happy New Year. Congratulations and thanks for joining us.
No, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you and you know, my second day on the job here, and just couldn't be happier to be a part of this organization and have a chance to talk with you today. You know, I started my career with Lockheed Martin about 25 years ago, and I actually started right here in Morristown, New Jersey, where this business is headquartered, working in the production part of the Aegis Weapons System program. So it's great to be back. I'm excited to be here and start the new year with you.
And before we get started, we are an SNA media partner, and our coverage of SNA this year is sponsored by Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, Leonardo DRS, and GE Marine. Our other sponsors include Leonardo DRS, that sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems of our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. And, you know, you mentioned the Aegis Weapons Systems system. I mean, it's been about five decades since that's been the heart of not only your business, but fleet, air, and missile defense. And the new ballistic missile defense baseline 5.4, and I apologize for our audience, we'll use the term baseline and some numbers, maybe a little bit more than we need to be doing on an ordinary basis, is the next generation of the capability that's going to be fielded this year. A lot of development work went into that last year. Bring us up to speed on the program and what the roadmap is to get this into the fleet as concerns about ballistic missile defense expand, not just in the Pacific theater, but, you know, with Russia, Iran, and even North Korea.
Yeah, well, certainly there's a lot happening, you know, on Aegis, in particular within what we call our Combat Systems Engineering Agent Contract, CSEA, which is where we really pull together the pieces of the Aegis combat system, you know, get that capability developed, integrated, and fielded. And so certainly, you know, getting that next release of capability out to the fleet is very important to us, and we're working through that process with the U.S. Navy. We have additional, you know, baseline development activities underway as well. If you look a little bit further to the future, we certainly have the integration of SPY 6 coming and working through the integration of baseline 10, which is another major area of focus for us. And we're working closely in partnership with the U.S. Navy as well as the manufacturer of SPY 6 to make sure that's successful. So a lot of good progress being made to continue to advance the baseline, keep the combat system mission relevant. You know, certainly, as you pointed out there, there's an evolving, you know, threat out there that we need to continue to stay on top of and focused on.
SPY 1, you know, you mentioned SPY 6. SPY 1 has been the Navy's baseline air defense radar for decades, but Raytheon has been selected for the advanced missile defense radar as the future capability. That said, your SPY 7 system has enjoyed quite some international success. Canada has selected it for its Type 26 frigates. Spain has it on its F1, is putting it on its F-100s and has it on its F-100s. And Japan is looking at it for its future ballistic missile defense ships. What's the outlook for the SPY-1, which you know, is in, you know, inventory in rather large numbers? And what does the outlook for the SPY-7 look like on the global market?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, SPY-1 is something we continue to look at as we sort of wrap up production of SPY-1 radars and think about how we continue to keep those mission relevant into the future. So we have worked through a couple of options to modernize the SPY-1 capability. So we have two products we call LNA and DLNA. LNA stands for Low Noise Amplifier, and it's basically a hardware and software enabled capability that we can backfit into SPY-1 to provide particularly more capability for the missile defense part of the mission space. But certainly the digital LNA capability we think has significant relevance both for MDA and for the surface Navy. So we're continuing to work on opportunities to backfit and upgrade the SPY-1 capability, even as we continue to invest in SPY-7. SPY-7 is something we're really excited about. You know, we really stepped back and took a look at the, you know, the solid state radar design and how to make it a more modular thought process going forward. So we've really put together what I think is a really flexible product that starts with some basic building blocks that can be configured in different numbers and in different ways to support different applications, different missions. So as you mentioned, you know, the LRDR, certainly we're looking at opportunities domestically with the Homeland Defense Radar and possibly Defense of Guam. And then internationally, I think you also touched on the work we're doing with Spain, with Canada for the Canadian Surface Combatant. And we also see a number of other international opportunities emerging, all sort of built on the same foundational building blocks, but putting those radars together in different configurations depending on the mission application. You know, I think you saw also the exciting news out of Japan about the SPY-7 selection and then the migration that they're planning to move from a land-based solution to a sea-based solution. So that's really a discussion that's evolving real time right now. We're staying close with MDA as those conversations continue with Japan. So a lot of opportunity, I think, both domestically and on the international market.
Do you have any sense in terms of unit or what you guys put that market at over the next decade or so?
I don't know that I could give you a specific market forecast at this point in time, but I would certainly say, you know, total opportunity, it would be north of $1 billion in unit sales over the next, you know, decade or so. And that could be a conservative number. But I think if you look at the domestic and international potential combined, there's a market there. It's north of $1 billion.
I'm going to ask you a little bit here in the littoral combat ship. You guys scored the first export order to Saudi Arabia and have been working that program. But I want to ask you about the LCS more broadly. The program began many years ago. It's now further along, I think, than a lot of people might recognize, that 21 and 23 will be delivered. Obviously, 32 ships in the total buy. Navy decided to go to a frigate for the remainder of the purchase. Folks are still waiting on the mission modules capability. I know I'm asking you this question because you're the prime contractor. I should point out also that our sponsor, Fincantieri Marinette Marine, is your partner on that program as well for construction out in Wisconsin. Talk to us a little bit about where we are on this program from a Lockheed Martin perspective, the capability that's being delivered, and how these later batch ships may, you know, have different capabilities than earlier ones.
Sure. Well, you know, where we are in terms of the overall LCS program is the Navy has procured a total of 16 Freedom class ships, which are the ones obviously Lockheed Martin's responsible for. And to date, we've delivered 10 of those 16. In August, the Navy commissioned LCS-19, the USS St. Louis. LCS-21 and LCS-23 completed sea trials and will be delivered in 2021. LCS-25 was launched in October of 2020, and that ship should be christened and undergo sea trials also in 2021. So the program continues to move forward well to plan. And certainly, as you pointed out, the first LCS does not look like the LCS we're delivering today. So we continue to take the lessons learned from the deployed vessels and factor those in as we continue to produce new ships. We've also had an ongoing dialogue with the Navy about lethality and survivability upgrades and what that could look like for LCS going forward. So certainly that's something that we haven't concluded yet in terms of the path forward, but we're exchanging ideas and thoughts on how to do that in an affordable way that attacks the problem piece by piece and continues to keep the LCS mission relevant.
You mentioned, John, that you guys are obviously pressing ahead with the program, and I mentioned the Saudi Arabia deal. Obviously, it is a vastly improved version of the ship that the United States Navy is getting. What's the status of that program? I know that there have been a little bit of political concern surrounding it, but I think the customer is eager to field the capability, and certainly you guys are, in order to see greater growth. Talk to us about where you are on the Saudi program and what you see as the international sales world roadmap for the LCS.
Certainly. So it is really a pleasure to have been selected by the Saudis to provide them with the multi-mission surface combatant. We refer to it as MMSC here in the U.S. It's referred to as a two-egg project in Kingdom. And it really is, as you said, it's a derivative of the LCS, but it incorporates, you know, I'd say enhanced lethality capability and departs a little bit from the LCS mission module design to full multi-mission capability. So it includes the Lockheed Martin Combat's 21 combat management system, as well as the Mark 41 VLS. So it's a little bit, a little bit of a departure from an LCS, but certainly that's where it has its roots. you know, so it's equipped with state-of-the-art, highly capable combat system, cyber secured. And I know we're going to talk a little bit more about cybersecurity later on today, but certainly that's a piece of our approach to the overall design. Has a shallow draft, has a range of about 5,000 nautical miles, speeds in excess of 30 knots. So I think for the environment we're going to be placing the ship in, it's ideally suited for the mission. In terms of the future, we do anticipate there's a possibility for a second lot of ships with the Saudis, and we're also talking to some other countries internationally, but we have not secured additional orders beyond the Saudi buy at this point in time. But we do believe there is a market out there, and there are some active prospects that we're talking with.
Now, are you comfortable giving sort of how many units, you know, is it a dozen, say, over the next decade, more, less? Do you have sort of a sense on what the roof on this market is?
You know, I would say there's potential out there for perhaps half a dozen to a dozen additional ships beyond what's currently on order.
And are you confident that that deal is going to go through? I mean, the Trump administration was very supportive, but there are concerns among some in Congress about arms sales to Saudi Arabia. You know, is it a concern at all that this program might get caught up in that? Or are you confident that the agreement is going to get executed as intended?
I don't have any indications at this point in time that there's a change in direction from the U.S. government. You know, I think with any international arms sale, there's always that risk. But right now, I wouldn't say there's any indication that things are going to change. But obviously, we have an administration change coming up. And with those administration changes can always come policy shifts. So we'll just continue, obviously, as we always do, to stay closely aligned with the U.S. government and make sure we're following their lead.
And certainly a shout out at this point, right? We can't mention this deal without mentioning retired Navy, United States Navy Vice Admiral Barry McCullough, who is truly just a naval giant, a good friend, and certainly a mentor to many in the Navy and in the surface warfare community who worked for Lockheed Martin and did such an extraordinary job getting that program over the finish line. I thought at some point he was going to qualify for Saudi citizenship. He was spending so much time there. So I'm very, very glad for him that the program is moving ahead.
Yes.
Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Mike Gilday is advocating more directed energy systems aboard frontline fleet units as being a key both from an offensive capability but also from a defensive capability. Your Helios laser is going to see this year aboard a destroyer for testing. Walk us through the program, why it's important to you, and what it means strategically, right? What are you guys trying to do in the directed energy and novel weapons space as everybody tries to increase both defensive range, defensive speed, as well as offensive punch?
Yeah, you know, this is an area that's really exciting for our corporation and for me personally. You know, about 10 years ago, I was working in our corporate R&D organization around the time that we made an acquisition of a small company in Bothell, Washington called Acculite, which really has formed the foundation of our directed energy strategy in Lockheed Martin. So for a decade, we've been investing in directed energy weapons, knowing that that would at some point become, you know, a reality for our military and for allied militaries. And it's really exciting to now see that, you know, that seedling investment a decade ago really mature into what we think is real, no kidding, fieldable laser weapon system technology. So as you mentioned, Helios is the most important program I think we have going right now with the Navy in directed energy. We were awarded the contract in 2018 for development, manufacturing, and delivery of the first system. And I had an opportunity to get hands-on Helios here in December, just before we packed up and shipped to Wallops Island. So we're out there going through testing at Wallops right now. Later on this year, as you said, we'll deliver it to a Block 2A Arleigh Burke destroyer and get that integrated on the ship and begin some real mission testing. So I think this testing is really going to prove out the viability and the utility of a directed energy weapon and how it really can be used in conjunction with kinetic weapons to really improve the, you know, the lethality of the fleet. And also, I think from an affordability perspective, if you think about the proliferation of the smaller threats, the UAVs, those sorts of things, how you could pair up a directed energy weapon with kinetic weapons and have a much deeper magazine and a much more affordable, defensive posture. I think it really makes a lot of sense. And the technology is real and it's here.
Exactly right. I mean, folks, even a couple of decades ago was saying that if we can get some of the beam related issues and then start working railgun, for example, you can get speed of intercept and a lower cost per shot, both offensively as well as defensively, which I think is one of the things that's propelling the CNO's roadmap on this. The Navy's also been working, John, on an unmanned vision, and Lockheed Martin has an enormous amount of experience, certainly on the aerial side, on the undersea side, as well as sea surface research that you guys have done in a very sort of novel series of thinking about what an automated future battle space looks like. What's Lockheed Martin's role in this market, and where do you guys see that going in the next decade? Because there are some, both in the fleet, but as well as up on Congress, that are skeptical of the Navy's plans. How do you envision this space and the role Lockheed Martin's going to play in it?
Yeah, I think this is another exciting area to talk about. And I had the privilege in my last job for 4 years of owning our undersea business, based out of Manassas, Virginia. And certainly we do a lot of work with the undersea Navy around unmanned systems. And, some of the higher profile engagements we've had were around the design phase of the XLUUV, the extra large unmanned undersea vehicle program. We're continuing to work with the Navy on some advanced studies around the future of XLUUV, and we're actively involved in the competition for the LDUUV. So I think the undersea Navy has made a pretty clear fist around unmanned as a piece of their overall undersea strategy, and they've started to put some money towards that strategy. So we see that moving forward, and it's something that we're going to continue to be a part of. As far as the surface Navy goes, the place we're really engaged is related to the large unmanned surface vessel, LUSV. We're currently under contract with the Navy to complete a study for an integrated payload ship that would be based on a commercially available ship design. And so we've put together a thought process here around leveraging Lockheed Martin's autonomy technology, which is based on the Sikorsky Matrix product. If you're familiar with the Matrix product, it's what enables the unmanned operation of Sikorsky's rotary wing platforms. And then we brought together that with Vigor, which is a ship design company that has a 100-year history of shipbuilding and ship repair for the Navy and Marine Corps. So we've put that together as an initial concept to respond to the study we're executing for the Navy, and we hope that will then lead to opportunities to expand from that study position more into a design phase contract.
The Navy's recent hacks on the U.S. government and industry networks have underscored the importance of cyber defenses. I should mention that our cyber coverage is sponsored by Northrop Grumman. What's your strategy to expand into this market? And what does the company want from Lockheed Martin, right? I mean, how do you see this market developing? Because folks keep talking about the importance of cyber and security, and we are investing money in it. But at the same time, we're also identifying vulnerabilities that we may not have considered, right? I mean, the Russians did this by compromising the entire software supply chain. What's the future of naval cyber, and what's the role you guys see playing in that market?
Yeah, our
and whether you think the customer has got a good enough vision about what its problems are to actually get the kind of solutions it needs ultimately.
I think our customers have a good handle on what the cyber threat space looks like, and I think the challenge that we all collectively face there, government and industry, is that cyber threat space changes on a daily basis. And one thing that's clear, having owned our cyber business in my prior role, is that cyber is not something that you can treat as a test condition at the end of the development process. You really have to integrate cyber defense into the design process from day one. And that's something that for all of our new programs, certainly we're doing. And we're also collaborating extensively across Lockheed Martin. Cyber is something that's common to all warfighting domains. It's common to all services and all customers. And so we've done, I think, a really nice job across our corporation of developing what we call our cyber resiliency model. And just like you would think about manufacturing readiness or technology readiness levels, we're looking at cyber resiliency through the same lens, because, you know, depending on the mission criticality of a particular weapon system and the environment in which it's going to operate, you may want to invest in different levels of cyber protection. So we've really thought about this as a tiered model that says, depending on the application, you may want to invest in different levels of resiliency, with the highest level obviously being the most cyber secure. So we put together a framework to allow ourselves to take either a new weapon system concept or an existing legacy weapon system design and sort of run it through a series of tabletop exercises to identify vulnerabilities, and then work through with our customers, you know, what's the cost benefit of going and addressing and remediating certain vulnerabilities. So we've actually piloted that framework with some of our undersea platforms. We've done some work with the surface Navy, and we will continue to do more, but it's a challenging problem, simply because the threat space just continues to evolve so rapidly, and something you have to stay on top of on a daily basis.
Let me ask you about your broader growth strategy. Lockheed Martin is one of the most important contractors the United States Navy has. As you said, the Aegis combat system is going to be the baseline for a long time. The busy one is the baseline system for the undersea force, something that you oversaw at your last division. At the same time, you guys have experienced a few setbacks, right? AMDR is one of them, that Raytheon won, Boeing won in the XLUUV space, and the new frigate is the first ship in a long time that doesn't have a large Lockheed Martin role on it. What's your growth strategy, especially looking at where you think, right? You guys keep a very close relationship. We spoke before we got started that, you know, the Navy strategies come and go. It remains to be seen where the Navy goes with its next, with its strategy, given that we're having a transition from the Trump to the Biden administration, right? So Biden will have a different view maybe than what the Trump administration does, but the Navy still has some core interests about where it wants to go. Given where you see where the Navy wants to go, what's your growth strategy for your unit?
Sure. Well, you know, I guess to start from the top down, we think about the customer strategy first, and we make sure we're aligned to that. And you know, with the recent release of the Tri-Service Maritime Strategy, you know, the first thing we do when a document like that comes out is we say, you know, certainly we've been talking to our Navy counterparts consistently over time, but is there anything in that document that surprises us? And I think for the most part, upon review, I would say generally not. I think that what we see in that document is pretty consistent with where, you know, the Navy's communicated to us that they're headed. Some of the things that stand out to me that were certainly encouraging bits of reinforcement, that the focus on joint all domain operations, I think, has been a consistent message from all of the U.S. services, and certainly an area where we see a lot of relevance, you know, as we think about the integration of capability that's already in inventory, and how do you, you know, leverage that to improve our warfighting capability. Certainly some focus on directed energy weapons, which is very consistent, as we already discussed, with the investments Lockheed Martin's been making for the past decade. And, you know, the overall, I think, thought process around modernization, which is wholly consistent with some of the investments we've been making in next generation solid state radar technology, for example. So, you know, taking it to the Lockheed Martin level, what's the growth strategy within my organization? You know, certainly as much as the AMDR competition was a setback for us, I think we've really recovered well with SPY-7. We talked about some of the domestic and international sales of SPY-7 and prospects for the future, I think, beyond what's already on contract. We're also investing in next generation air defense radar capability, which would replace our TPS-77 product. It's more of a ground-based product versus a surface-based product, but certainly I think continues to strengthen our radar franchise in general. You know, beyond the radar part of the business, naval combat systems in general, I think that part of the business remains strong. We see a strong future for continued modernization of the Aegis combat system and extending, you know, our combat system capabilities more broadly across the fleet as modernization continues. The surface combatant area, I think I wouldn't necessarily call that a growth segment, but one where I do see continued business coming from Saudi Arabia and potentially other countries beyond that sale. So I would say that's going to be a steady part of the business in the near future. Laser weapons is an area where I have great hope for the future. As I said, I think the work that we're doing with the Navy to deploy Helios and get some testing happening with that weapon system this year, I think when we see positive results out of those test events, that'll really open the door for, you know, expanded sales of our laser weapon systems. And I do think Lockheed Martin is a market leader in that area. And I think then to round it out, you know, from a strategic perspective, the unmanned segment is probably the part that's a little bit further over the horizon, where I see some seed corn being planted today, but I do see an opportunity there for, you know, for the Navy to extend their reach through, through that LUSV capability and other similar unmanned surface vessels. And then tying it all together, you know, we haven't talked a lot about all domain operations, but in the job I came from, which was leading a, you know, our undersea business, our cyber business, and our command and control business, we were focused heavily on all domain operations. And some of the work we're doing in that area is incorporates the virtualized Aegis weapon system, or VAWS. You know, that that proven, robust fire control capability that's resident in Aegis, I think, has a lot of application beyond the current ship-based applications. And certainly we're incorporating that into our overall architecture for all domain operations to include some international opportunities that are active today. So I think the future for their business is bright, the growth strategy is strong, and I'm really excited about the future of this organization.
Let me ask you two very brief follow-ups. How scalable is the laser technology, right? Because when it comes to lasers, you know, there's a sense that you sort of, there's a limit to how much power you can put through them. And so there are folks who regard that as a lower altitude counter drone, counter small UAV, whereas others maintain that actually you can scale the technology up quite a bit to be able to get better effects at particularly faster moving targets. What's your vision in terms of the scalability of the technology? Because you guys work the state of the art and have worked the state of the art for some time.
Well, I'll say two things about that. First off, I would say that we see a clear path to a 300 kilowatt laser. In fact, we're under contract with OSD right now to provide a 300 kilowatt laser, and that's actively, you know, moving through the development process today. So I think we see a clear path to higher powered lasers that can be relevant for larger targets. So that's part number one. Part number two, I would say, is having been at this for 10 years now, every time you go to the next threshold of power, you do encounter new challenges. But right now, we don't see anything other than just good, focused engineering work to get from where we are today at the sub 100 kilowatt level to 300 or so in the next couple of years. So the potential, I think, is there to have this be a much more lethal weapon system to defend against larger targets. It's just going to take a little more time and a little bit more focused engineering to get to that level of power.
And one last question. You know, you mentioned that JADC2, and you were the C6 ISR boss for Lockheed Martin in your last job. There is a question that folks have about connectivity, right? So if you have the LUSV, the large unmanned surface vessel, and it becomes that floating magazine, there were questions that some have about, okay, well, how do you cross-connect that in an over-the-horizon way, in a secure way, right? Which is an issue that you tend not to worry about, for example, if you've got 100 VLS tubes, Mark 41s on your ship. How have you guys worked that security of connectivity piece of this, including how you manage to do this, for example, in an emission-controlled environment where you might have to communicate less without exposing yourself to fire? How have you guys worked some of those conceptual level connectivity issues that for some go to the heart of the utility of, you know what I mean? It's a brilliant idea if you can work out some of those kinds of challenges ultimately.
Yeah, well, I think step number one is to make sure that whatever you deploy when you're talking about an unmanned platform is the cyber hardening and the security aspect of the platform is paramount. You know, you certainly would never want to deploy something that could be remotely compromised and repurposed by an adversary. So that's something that certainly goes into the design process from day one as we think about it. You know, we certainly, from an autonomy perspective, we want to think about, especially in the unmanned domain, how do you deploy a platform that may not be able to communicate for very long periods of time? And how do we think about the conditions that vehicle may encounter along the way, and what are those, you know, what are those use cases and what are the scenarios and how you'd respond to those. So we do a lot of thinking about that. We're putting a lot of energy and investment into next generation communications capabilities. You know, there's a large initiative within Lockheed Martin around what we call 5G.mil. So as we look to next generation communications protocols like 5G and what those can mean in terms of mission capability for our military services, how do we leverage those commercial standards and militarize them, harden them, secure them, and deploy them to enhance the capability of the fleet. So there's a lot of work happening in that area, a lot of tough problems to solve, but I think it starts with making sure that you have as robust a communications infrastructure as possible, and that it's you know, resistant to compromise, and that your platforms have the intelligence installed on them to know what to do when they do lose comms, and make sure that what they're doing is, you know, certainly safe and in line with mission expectations.
John, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Fair winds following seas, and I wish we could be meeting in person. So I've got my fingers crossed that maybe later on in 2021, we'll be able to do that. Thanks so very much.
Would be fantastic. Thank you so much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.